Welcome to Pick Me Up, I'm Scared, the podcast. Hi, I'm your host, Kenna.
And I'm your co-host, Madeline.
Welcome to Pick Me Up, I'm Scared, the podcast.
So today, we're doing another Kenna podcast.
Whoop whoop.
This is Kenna's second time where she's doing all the research and she will be presenting to me.
Yeah, well, we'll see how it goes, you know.
I'm excited. I'm excited.
This is a little bit different than our other ones. I thought I would, like, you know, maybe bring some dreaminess, imagination, you know, some sci-fi into it.
I like that. I love all that. That all sounds very you to me, and I'm on board. I can't wait for what's to come.
All right. So, Madeline, tell me what you think the definition of utopia is.
Ooh, okay. So I imagine that a utopia is like a goal on the horizon. So the definition is probably something about being like an idyllic community structure of like imagined potential, something along the lines of that, that's not actually concretely achieved.
Yes, you know, I think you've got it, because basically, you know, the Wikipedia definition is, quote, an imaginary community or society that possesses highly desirable or nearly perfect qualities for its citizens. So basically every, like, you know, definition of utopia, it's kind of like it's like a little bit amorphous, but generally it has two things going on. One is that it is imaginary and it is not achieved yet. And two is that it is a, you know, vision of a better future. You know, so to me, it's basically, you know, a utopia doesn't exist, but it is an ideal place to live compared to the time, place, and culture in which we currently live, or the person describing it currently lives. You know, Ruth Levitas, in their book, utopia, or, you know, the concept of utopia, Levitas says, utopia is about how we would live and what kind of world we would live in if we could do just that. And utopia, as colloquially understood, contains two meanings, a good but non-existent and therefore impossible society.
Ooh, interesting.
Yeah, there's many, you know, definitions of utopia. This is from Utopianism, a very short introduction by Lyman Tower Sargent. They quote Suvin from 1930, quote, the verbal construction of a particular quasi-human community where socio-political institutions, norms, and individual relationships are organized according to a more perfect principle than in the author's community, this construction being based on estrangement arising out of an alternative historical hypothesis. So that is like the fancy academic version. And Sargent's definition is basically a non-existent society described in considerable detail and normally located in time and space that the author intended a contemporaneous reader to view as considerably better than the society which the reader lived.
Yeah, that all makes sense to me. So it's something, yeah, it's a better world that we're imagining.
Yeah, which is like, and imaginary.
And it's always just on the horizon, just out of reach. But I think the idea, right, is that, like, it's not, even though it seems impossible, because every time you advance, like, the idea of the utopia advances too, it's like something, it's the carrot on the stick we should run for.
Yes. And I like this definition. This is Utopias and Dystopias, Definitions and Characteristics. And this is from readwritethink.org. Their definition is, quote, a place, state, or condition that is ideally perfect in respect of politics, laws, customs, and conditions. This does not mean that the people are perfect, but the system is perfect.
Oh, I like that distinction. That's interesting.
I like that distinction where, you know, people are inherently flawed. You know, we're all nuanced. You know, if not flawed, we are nuanced creatures.
Yes.
Like, we are very complex. People themselves are very complex. I think it would be I mean, I think it's a little naive to think that every singular person is going to behave their best at every single moment.
Yeah, I don't do that, like, ever. I'm never my best. My best is only actually, like, 90% capacity of bestness. So I think at any given time, I'm running between 25 to 40%.
Yeah, but I think I like this because it's like, well, if the system and the place in which people live runs as best as possible, like the entire structure runs as best as possible, people are more likely to be at their 90%.
Yeah.
Their 90 to 99%. I don't know if we can ever be 100%.
No. No, we cannot. Mm-mm.
It'd be too weird.
Yeah. I mean, I think also it's that thing where, like, we, like, need an outlet, right, sometimes. So if you were at your best 100% of the time, like, maybe the only thing that can exist is, like, a Purge type scenario. Which, like, I've never even actually seen The Purge.
I haven't either.
I've just heard people talk about The Purge. I just know about it. Right. So, like, yeah, maybe you could be, like, 100%, like, 364 days out of the year. But then one day you're just, like, killing people because they cut you off at the gas station or something. That's my understanding.
Yeah, plus it's also subjective, you know?
It is. I like the idea that it's like your personal best should never be 100. It should be around the 90 range.
Because, yeah, 90 to 99.
I like that.
Yeah. I also like the readwritethink.org, their characteristics of utopian society. One is information, independent thought, and freedom are promoted. 2, a figurehead or concept brings the citizens of the society together, but not treated as singular. 3, citizens are truly free to think independently. 4, citizens have no fear of the outside world. 5, citizens live in harmonious state. 6, the natural world is embraced and revered. 7, citizens embrace social and moral ideals. Individuality and innovation are welcome. And the society evolves with change to make a perfect utopian world. So I feel like that's more in, like, science fiction, stuff like that. That's, like, many characteristics. Although I think a lot of people would beg to differ on, you know.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting how specific they got.
That felt, like, really specific because I was
the,
like,
the author's utopia. Their bias, yes, came out.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm like, oh, so. But I think it's like when we think of, like, utopian fiction, we think of a lot.
Right.
Of these.
The thing that was extra interesting to me from that, the list of characteristics, is the, like, revolving around a figurehead or central concept.
Yes. And that is when, you know, I will be talking about the history of the term utopia. But Plato, in his Republic, which is kind of one of the first proto-utopian, you know, writings, his utopia is based around a philosopher king who does, who is just.
That's so it's interesting.
It's very based around, like, time, place, culture at the time, the views of, like.
That part makes sense to me. I feel like the emergence of a figurehead is usually a central idea of dystopia, though.
That is true.
So I'm like, oh, it's interesting that the author of that, the list of characteristics, included it as a utopic principle, because, well, to me, I'm like, that's where things start to go wrong.
Yeah, it's interesting, though, in the book The Dispossessed by Ursula K. Le Guin, in their anarchist utopia on the moon, they do have a figurehead who founded their society, who they all look up to as, like, oh, she had Odo, who, like, oh, she, like, brought us so many texts and ideals. But it's not like Odo is a queen or, like, the leader. Like, it's almost like a weird, not quite spiritual advisor, but, like, a person who wrote down a lot of, like, it, like, almost like the marks of the utopian moon society.
It's like a conceptual. So that's kind of, I think, too, in that list where they talked about, like, it could be a person, but it could also be, like, a concept that, yeah, ties people together,
where it's like, loosely, that's what the society is kind of based around, though there's lots of wiggle room, and it's, like, more nuanced than just, like, we worship this,
yes,
figurehead, or, like,
interesting,
we have a king or queen, mm-hmm, which I think in our society, we always think that there needs to be, like, the leader.
Right.
Rather,
yeah,
than, like, excuse me, like, maybe something different, like organization, or, you know, something different than just, like, the person or idea, right, that, you know, controls everything else.
Yeah, last night, this actually reminds me that I realized last night that my idea of a utopic society is so different than so many other people's, because when most people think about things they hate about the government, they hate the bureaucracy. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking last night and I was like, man, that's the only thing I like about the government. I love the bureaucracy. I want bureaucracy with no hierarchy. And I was just thinking, like, that is probably not a very popular viewpoint.
Yeah, it's interesting, though, in that book, The Dispossessed, they do have a bureaucracy without hierarchy. And it's kind of like, you can go to this place and you can work there and be assigned there if you want. Yeah. But you don't have to.
Interesting.
You don't have to do anything. But again, it's more nuanced than that. It's like, it's kind of the thing where it's like, the structure is really good, but the people aren't perfect.
Yes, I like that. Okay, so then what are the dystopic characteristics?
The dystopian characteristics, I have some right here. This is also from the same readwritethink.org.
Okay.
Characteristics of a dystopian society. One, propaganda is used to control the citizens of society.
That sounds familiar.
Two, information, independent thought, and freedom are restricted. Three, a figurehead or concept is worshipped by the citizens of the society, which is interesting because they also said figure or concept.
Right.
Four, citizens are perceived to be under constant surveillance. Five, citizens have a fear of the outside world. Six, citizens live in a dehumanized state. Seven, the natural world is banished and distrusted. And citizens conform to uniform expectations. Individually and dissent are bad. Also, the society is an illusion of a perfect utopian world.
Got it. So like the United States now.
Yeah.
Yeah. Got it. We live in dystopia. Dystopia now.
Yeah, basically. So dystopia is the flip side of utopia.
Yes.
You know, Mad Max, 1984, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, there was another good movie I was trying to think of. I will remember it later.
Cherry 2000.
Best dystopian movie.
After which my car is named. Best movie.
So, do you know anything about where utopia came from?
It was some old guy wrote a book called Utopia.
You are ding, ding, ding.
Yes,
right.
And there were like these, okay, wait. I'm trying to remember everything that I ever learned about this in high school. This guy wrote the book and it was like Utopia. And then, his name's on the tip of my tongue and it has an H in it, but that's not helpful. And then all these people went out and tried to build their own utopias after they read it and build these little communities, like isolated kind of in nature. But they were really small scale, more communes. But it was inspired by this book. And then there was like a whole utopia movement that followed.
Well, yeah. So the term utopia does come from Sir Thomas More.
Yeah, that's the one. And no H. I invented that. Okay, got it.
Book of the same name. It's from 1516. There are many, the ideal of utopia goes back, you know, a long time, but Sir Thomas More, he coined the term utopia, which in Greek means nowhere or no place.
Oh.
An interesting thing is utopia, beginning with an E, so E-U-topia, means good place, which I thought was very interesting.
Oh, that is interesting. I like that.
Kind of like there's a long history of utopia. Utopias in many cultures is like kind of a myth or origin story. Like something I would think of is the Garden of Eden, for example.
Oh, yeah.
In like Christianity. Ruth Levitas, in their book, The Concept of Utopia, says, "The construction of imaginary worlds, free from the difficulties that beset us in reality, takes place in one form or another in many cultures. Such images are embedded in origin and destination myths, where the good life is not available to us in this world, but is confined to a lost golden age in a world beyond death."
Oh, so it's like a heaven construct.
Kind of, yeah. I think it's interesting how so many of us think back to a place where there was like an idyllic time before now. Like, you know, in Christianity, it's like the Garden of Eden, or, you know, I feel like on one end of the spectrum, we think about, oh, like idyllic, like maybe like hunter-gatherer, indigenous societies. But then on like the extreme worse end, it's people who are like MAGA, who think of this like idyllic American past that never existed.
Oh, right.
You know.
The freedom to be just as racist and sexist and homophobic as you want without anybody holding you accountable.
Yeah.
That's their utopia.
Yeah. So I think, you know, a lot of it has to do with like, there is like a sense of, you know, in like humanity where a lot of people think like, oh, a desire for a better place or thinking about a different place or a time when it was better is possibly like very in our nature, or it's just very around in the world.
It's like a nostalgia almost.
Yeah.
But we idealize elements of the past that maybe weren't that perfect to begin with.
Oh, for sure. And to go back to that book, you know, Utopia, which is like the first, you know, in that. And it was actually meant to be satirical.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. And it his book consists of real letters to people at the time to make it seem more realistic. But apparently it's full of jokes. It's not meant to be taken very seriously. But this is from the Wikipedia page talking about it, which I thought had a really good quote. His real correspondent, quote, allowed him to discuss some of the modern ills affecting Europe at the time, such as the tendency of kings to start wars and the subsequent loss of money on fruitless endeavors. He also criticizes the use of execution to punish theft, saying thieves might as well murder whom they robbed to remove witnesses if the punishment is going to be the same. He lays most of the problems on theft on the practice of enclosure, the enclosing of common land, and the subsequent poverty and starvation of people who are denied access to land because of sheep farming.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, so from what I gather, this book is about kind of working within the flawed system, in this case, the monarchy and the Catholic Church, I believe, to make them better rather than basically starting from scratch. So he imagines this imaginary island in the New World, which is the Americas at the time, and he lays out the society in great detail.
Interesting. It's also interesting that his utopia is just like colonization and like genocide for yes. others. So it's like almost a manifest destiny thing. Like your utopia at the expense of whom and what?
Yes. And basically, you know, what many people say is dystopia and utopia are very like intertwined. They're two sides of like a similar coin, I guess. From what I gather, many people believe the formation of the United States was inspired by utopian ideas.
I think that I've heard that before, too. And I think I heard that it was just a bunch of drunk guys sitting in a bar, like, what if we made a better country? And then they just wrote all their plans on, like, bar napkins, basically. And then they were like, oh, fuck, it's kind of working.
Yeah. And Levitas also, you know, says that utopias reflect the society we have at the time, basically. Quote, it allows for this desire to be realistic or unrealistic. It allows for the form, function, and content to change over time. And it reminds us that whether we think of particular utopias, we learn a lot about the experience of living under any set of conditions by reflecting upon the desires which those conditions generate and yet leave unfulfilled.
That makes a lot of sense to me. Yeah, because it is. It's a reflection of what you view to be lacking from your society. So, you know, the things you take for granted are the things that you experience, right, in your world. So those might not be reflected as strongly if you were to imagine a better world because you've taken them for granted, right? So they don't need to be improved upon. So the things you would focus on if you were writing utopia would be the things that do need improvement based on your current condition. So I could totally see that, how like the utopia, if it's like written, is a reflection, or storytelling, however, like the media is set up, like the utopia is a reflection of what's lacking in the society that the person born into who wrote the utopia has experienced.
Yeah, and I think about that, the Plato thing where he thought that the ideal society would just be a philosopher king. And he never thought to think of, well, why does there need to be a king? Why does there right. need to be a monarchy? It kind of reminds me of that Ursula K. Le Guin quote where it's like, there was a time when people could not imagine like the birth, like there wasn't anything besides the birthright of kings and a monarchy, or, you know, and I think, you know, and in the future, we, you know, and right now we couldn't imagine a system besides capitalism or what we have now.
Right. We can't even imagine a world without money.
Yeah. So people think, well, instead of being a world without money or without capital, we just think, oh, well, it would be better if people just had better working hours. Like, to some people, that's a utopia.
Yeah. Or people had more money.
Yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So it, I thought that was very, like, interesting.
That is interesting.
Yeah. And there's, like, you know, there's different aspects of utopia. There's intentional communities. There, you know, there's utopia in science fiction and literature. And there's many different types of, like, utopian ideas. And, like, there's a lot of examples of intentional communities in the United States. According to the National Park Service, on their page about utopias in America, utopian communities can be traced back to the 19th century utopian sects. They can trace their roots back to the Protestant Reformation. Based on the organization of early Christian communities, communal living developed and grew largely within monastic communities, during the Middle Ages, this communal organization spread to outside of monastic context and into several lay religious groups. So, yeah, it seems like a lot of, like, first, like, you know, utopian societies were very communal, monastic, like, what I would think of now is, like, college campuses or, like, something like that. And American utopian or intentional communities included groups such as the Shakers, who make the furniture, and Oneida, and the ones who make the cookware.
What?
Yes.
Wait, what? I know about the cabinets because I got the Shaker style cabinets in my kitchen. What is the cookware?
Well, I don't know a lot about Oneida, but I have listened to a podcast about.
Okay, okay.
Basically, I believe, early 19th century, they were kind of like almost like a free love community style, and they practice like having, I think, multiple marriages.
They were poly icons.
Yes. I think there was some more stuff going on there.
Oh, okay. So they were poly, drop the icons, and cannot be confirmed.
Okay. But basically, I thought it was interesting. Like, wow, there's so many communities that end up making stuff.
I like that, actually. That's kind of a punk thing, too, because, you know, I had a partner who was in, like, the late 70s, early 80s punk scene in L.A., and a lot of those kids would get kicked out of their parents' house, and they had friends who were a little older who had their own place, and when the punk kids would get kicked out of their house, they would all go live with their older friends, mm-hmm. this couple. And the couple, they were like, okay, well, we're going to teach you all skills. So they taught them how to do screen printing, do woodworking, so they all could work. And they built this kind of communal living situation on this property where they would, in order to survive as a group, they'd like take random jobs and gigs around town. And they'd be like, okay, we're going to make this woodworking thing. We're going to screen print these shirts for this band, you know, and that's kind of how they all worked together and got the money to pay for the food and pay for the rent. And I thought that was really cool, but it is very much like communal living, and you start doing craft-based things because that's a way to bring income and resources mm-hmm. to your community, and it's something everyone can participate in.
Yeah, and, you know, we see utopian communities in, like, communes in the 1960s, for good or for ill,
yes.
you know, and now with more intentional communities, people who come together who are outside of what we would consider the nuclear family.
Right. I also, you might talk about this later, but I'm curious because I do see a lot of the intentional communities kind of like slippery slope into weird cult.
Yes.
Like, where is the overlap of utopia and weird cults?
Yes. I feel like that's that a lot, because I, for a second, was listening or like reading a lot about like Jonestown or like Nexium, which are supposedly like, we're going to make you better. And then it's like, whoa.
Right.
That got weird real fast.
I wonder where the breaking point is. I think it's in the individuality thing. Remember how you were talking about the definitions and characteristics of utopia, and one of them was that, like, individuality and freedom of thought is encouraged? Mm-hmm. But I feel like the weird cult vibes happens when the collectivism, the drive for collectivism, becomes so, like, overwhelming that there's no opportunity or space for individuality left. Maybe that's the breaking point?
Yeah, and, like, the, you know, like, they both the utopian and dystopia had, you know, many times a figurehead.
Right.
And it seems like when there's too much emphasis on the figurehead and, like, doctrine rather than, like, yeah, individual thought and freedom, that's where things get really
interesting.
Yeah.
Okay. I like this.
Yeah. And so we know a lot about utopia, you know, in science fiction. According to Raymond William in Science Fiction Studies, if we analyze the fictions that have been grouped as utopian, we can distinguish four types. A, the paradise, in which a happier life is described as simply existing elsewhere. B, the externally altered world, in which a new kind of life has been made possible by an unlooked-for natural event. C, the willed transformation, in which a new kind of life has been achieved by human effort. And D, the technological transformation, in which a new kind of life has been made possible by a technical discovery.
Okay.
So so it seems like there's a couple of them. Like, for example, like in that movie, like, I think it's, what is it? Shangri-La?
Oh, I don't know. I haven't seen
it. But it's basically like these people happen upon this little area that they've never, that's nowhere on the map, but it's like heaven, like, no one ages and no one is ill and no one dies and it's all perfect. So that's just like, or like a heaven where it's just like, it's someplace else.
Yeah.
That we can't get to.
I like that too. The idea that, like the mythical someplace else, you know, it's, not quite achievable, right? Which ties into like the definition mm-hmm. of utopia. But also it's escapism. It's like literal escapism. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You're like, how could I escape my life? And you're like, there's a magical place you can go to.
Yeah. And then, you know, in other, you know, ones, it's like through technological discovery. Like, you know,
the robots will do the work for us.
The robots will do everything.
Yes.
And then, or like Star Trek.
Yeah. Yes.
Like, yeah, I think like, yeah, like Star Trek, there is like, yeah, which I think covers maybe a lot of the other ones where it's like, we work towards, we actively try to make the utopia and we have technology, we work for it, we try for it. And maybe there was some sort of like natural event that occurred that sped up the process. Mm-hmm. I am not a Trekkie, so I'm not sure of the, and like, I think about, you know, another example of sci-fi utopianism is Afrofuturism.
Oh, yeah.
And that's a term that is coined by Mark Derry in the essay Black to the Future in 1994. Wikipedia's definition is, it's a cultural, aesthetic, philosophy of science, and philosophy of history that explores the developing intersection of African diaspora culture with technology. Like I think of works of Afrofuturism, including works by Octavia Butler, music by Sun Ra, and the movie Black Panther.
Yeah, Black Panther's a great example, right?
Yeah.
I actually was reading somebody talking about Afrofuturism, and they were talking about the importance, like the cultural significance of Afrofuturism, which is like to imagine what world could have been, mm-hmm. like if colonization had not completely obliterated like resources of communities in Africa, or like kind of like prohibited natural growth of like mm-hmm. economies and art and culture. So it was really interesting reading about like the idea of like Afrofuturism and what it means from like a utopic standpoint, and like the potential for like a culture to survive and prosper. It's really cool.
Yeah. Side note, on Criterion Collection, they have a really cool Afrofuturism like movie selection.
Oh,
that's really good.
That's cool.
Yeah, I watched this movie called Welcome to the Terror Dome, which is really intense, just forewarning, mm. but it was so good.
There was
but that was very dystopian, but
oh, okay.
but imagine like there was a like utopian elements to it, mm-hmm. but it was very dystopian, but very good. So good.
Yeah. I'm trying to think if there was like a band that was super popular that their whole, it like wasn't Parliament Funkadelic, I don't think, but something like that where all of their like visuals were all very Afrofuturism too. It's like a really popular band from like, but I can't. So whatever.
Yeah. That reminds me of Sun Ra, but there, I feel like there's a lot of other.
Yeah.
Like too, that's like, it's hard to like remember on the fly. I feel like, so hard. Like when I go home tonight, I'd be like, I now remember.
Yeah.
There's many types of, utopian ideas. Lyman Tower Sargent argues that that there are many different types of utopia. There are socialist, capitalist, monarchical, democratic, anarchist, ecological, feminist, patriarchal, egalitarian, hierarchical, racist, left-wing, right-wing, reformist, free love, nuclear family, extended family, gay, lesbian, and many other more utopias, including naturism and nude Christians. Utopian, some argue, is essential for the improvement of the human condition, but if used wrongly, it becomes dangerous. Utopia has an inherent contradictory nature here.
That's interesting. One of my friends loaned me a book a couple months ago to read called Cruising Utopia.
Yes, I was just... Yeah, that is an example of like a queer-centered
utopia. Yeah, queer-centered utopia. And one of the things they talk about, the author talks about how utopia is always on the horizon and you can never quite reach it, and like what that means for like the queer community and how mm-hmm. like the duty of the queer community is to work towards utopia even if you know it's a mirage mm-hmm. on the horizon. I don't know. I thought it was really cool.
Yeah, I think it's really cool, and I think it's... There are many different viewpoints of utopia, and it's so interesting to me that Sargent also thinks that along with that is also this current of dystopia. Like, if you think of, like, bad utopias.
Right, there's a tipping point, a breaking point.
Yeah.
Interesting.
And, yeah, it's so interesting. I'm, like, trying to think of, like... the dystopian movie that I was thinking about. Dystopian movies for me, of course, are Mad Max, Terminator 2.
Oh, yeah, that's a good one.
But I feel, or, you know, like 1984, but I feel like there's a lot of, like, dystopian stuff that, like, we just don't think about because we just tend to think about, like, oh, that's the future. It's gonna suck.
Mm, that's true. We think of it as an inevitability rather than, yeah, like,
Yeah, I think a lot of people think that humanity is just so inherently shitty that, like, any attempts at making a better society will lead to bad outcomes. And I don't know if there's any proof that people are inherently shitty.
No, I don't think there is. In fact, I think that all of, like, the evidence points to the opposite, which is that if you create a society or a culture or an environment that is positive, people respond to that and become more positive. And if you create like an environment or society or culture that's negative and hostile and aggressive, people will become more defensive and cagey because they're in like survival mode if they feel that they're being attacked at all times. So I think that the evidence actually shows that people are like sponges. We absorb what's around us and we give back what we think we need to in order to survive. But if you take out the survival element, I think that people are more inclined to like flourish and thrive when their mm-hmm. needs are met.
Yeah. And I think, again, this puts so much like, you know, on the individual rather than the community or the system at hand. And like, I personally think from everything that I've seen or read that humans or people or creature, whoever, like generally do better when we work together. Like yes. that is, it's not some Ayn Rand survival of the fittest. It's like survival of the community.
Right.
Like, and you know,
I do think that's interesting though. The thing you said about how we have a hard time identifying dystopia in media because we view it not as dystopia or like a forewarning of something more difficult that could happen, but we view it as the inevitability of our own future. Mm-hmm. So we view it just as like, yeah, science fiction or like the truth down the line. What will like Tank Girl,
Yes.
How all of the water gets privatized. And you watch it and you're like, this isn't dystopia. This will happen.
This is going to happen.
The water will become privatized.
Oh my gosh. So to me, that comes to my next point is like the function of utopia. And, you know, what do you think is the function of utopia or the utopian?
Okay, well, I like the idea of it being on the horizon. I mentioned this earlier. It's like the carrot on the stick. Like, you're never quite going to reach it, but if you run to it, you'll get a little bit closer. And you just have to keep on running to it on the horizon, even though it's a mirage and you'll never actually reach it. But that's okay, because that's how progress happens. It allows mm-hmm. you the freedom and the space to imagine a better world. And there's like that Arundhati Roy quote, which I've said before, which is something about like, a better future is not only possible, it's on the horizon.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's coming, and we need to be able to imagine it in order to obtain it or achieve it or some yeah. semblance of it.
And it's very like present and time focused, where it's like you're doing everything that you can now in the hopes of a better future.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Or like, I mean, maybe is utopia, oh, this is off, you know, question, but I'm like, is utopia always necessarily based on the future, or can it also be incorporated to our present?
Well, I think that's kind of like the idea of like escapism and the commune, mm-hmm. right? And people talk about that. Like, is communal living or like starting a commune, is that something that's an escape from reality? Is that abandoning your community at large mm-hmm. to go play pretend that there's a better world? You can never fully escape your community, right? Because all of the land that's in the world has been plotted and claimed and charted and belongs to somebody, and you're subject to the rules of that territory wherever you mm-hmm. are. So you can never fully escape and be on your own with your own community that you can build from the ground up. But you can do, you know, some things. And is that like an escapism, or is that putting into practice the act of imagining a better world?
That's so interesting.
Are you abandoning people, or are you using your two hands to create something that could be better?
Yeah, and it just goes to show the paradoxical nature of just the utopia.
Right.
Yeah, so interesting. I feel like what the function of utopia is it might, you know, be something that is necessary. I'm using a quote from Ruth Levitas again. Utopia is something that naturally comes to humans, imagining a better world. It may also be absolutely necessary for our survival, especially, you know, and especially in the face of climate crisis. Those are my own words. This is the quote from Levitas. Since capital accumulation necessitates continued and untrammeled expansion of global production and consumption, and does so in ways that intensifies inequalities and render the poorest most exposed to environmental hazard, alternative modes of organization may be necessary for human survival. To borrow from René Dumont, what we are faced with is utopia or else.
Wow, I like that. Utopia or else is a very catchy...
Yeah, and I think about it where it's like, with everything that we're seeing with, you know, the upcoming climate crisis, like, unless things are changed very rapidly, we face a very possibly dire, you know, future.
Right.
With the climate. This is a quote from the philosopher, I can never say it, Slavoj Zizek. There are two false meanings of utopia. One is this old notion of imagining this ideal society we know will never be realized. The other is the capitalist utopia in the sense of new perverse desire that you are only allowed but even solicited to realize. The true utopia is when the situation is so without issue, without the way to resolve it within the coordinates of the possible, that out of the purge urge of survival, you have to invent a new space. Utopia is not kind of a free imagination utopia. It is a matter of innermost urgency. You are forced to imagine it. It is the only way out, and this is what we need today.
Wow.
Yeah. And another famous, you know, utopic quote from Oscar Wilde, and this is, "A map of the world that does not include utopia is not even worth glancing at. for it leaves out the one country at which humanity is always landing. And when humanity lands there, it looks out and, seeing a better country, sets sail. Progress is the realization of utopia.
Very interesting.
Yeah, I like this idea of, utopia or else.
Yeah, I like the idea of utopia or else. It's interesting because the Oscar Wilde quote, that was the last one, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's almost at odds with the other ones. Yeah, the other two quotes are like, look, it's this thing that, you know, we have to have in concrete terms. It has to be concretely realized. We have to take the imaginary element away from it. And then you have Oscar Wilde being like, no, it will always be imaginary. And, like, that's just what you're aiming for, mm-hmm. and we do our best. But the idea of how realistic and plausible, like, utopia is in terms of our future, like, that is a very interesting kind of battle, right? Like, yeah. You have our future, which is real and concrete and tangible and has to happen either way. And then you have, like, an imagined potential future, which is amorphous and could be anything. Mm-hmm. And the idea that utopias were always innately imaginary, like, what does that mean for our future?
Yeah. And it's like, it kind of, like, fries my brain a little bit, where I'm like, whoa, like, we have to do it, but it's always aspirational.
Right.
And I think that's, like, one of, like, a good function of thinking about utopia is, like, kind of the paradoxical nature of our existence. Because I feel like many times when we have conversations or we think about it in our lives, we think of it as very one or the other. It's either A or B, like, you think this way or you think that way. When in reality, a lot of the things that we think about or interact with are more nuanced and, like, gooey and, like, amorphous. And I feel like it's a good way to exercise your brain. I don't know. That's what
to be aware that more than one thing can be true at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I like that. I think that could be true, that utopia is always, like, by definition, necessarily imaginary and fake, but then also, like, society can't function knowing that. You have to function with the understanding that it's possible and achievable, and we're going to do it.
Yeah, you need the hope, you know?
The hope, exactly.
Because if you're just like, well, everything's going to be shitty anyway, why progress, you know?
Right. You can't think of it as an inevitable failure.
Yeah. So, what does your version of utopia look like?
Ooh, I like this.
But how about your sci-fi utopia first?
Okay. My sci-fi utopia. All right. The first element of my sci-fi utopia is that we've tackled aging. Everyone can live forever.
Ooh, it's like In Time. One of my favorite movies.
Okay, so everyone can live forever, but, you know, then you have the rest be, like, as self-sufficient as possible. Like, you have the tall buildings, you want the urban density, because the urban density is good. Then you need green space, so where does the green space go? So then you have to build green spaces into your living scenario, so you have them on your rooftops, and your rooftops all are community gardens that grow all the food for everyone in the building, and maybe some floors of your tall buildings and your urban density to, you know, accommodate the population growth because of the living forever thing. Then you have whole floors taken out with natural light and they're greenhouses instead of, like, living conditions. So then you start thinking about, like, if you could live forever, what would you do with your time? And you would become an expert in so many things. So you have all these people who spend their time becoming experts in all sorts of different fields, and knowledge then becomes, like, the center of your society, and education and, like, extended learning. So everyone spends all their time just learning and acquiring new skills. And because of that, all of our systems and functions in society that, like, are necessary for society to operate, right, they are more efficient, because the people working on them are all experts. The people working on them are like, I've been studying this for 300 years. I know the most efficient way to make this happen. So then you get into, like, the work, and we work fewer hours because the systems are all running efficiently. And, you know, a lot of choice, a lot of freedom to do and pursue whatever you want to do, and the freedom to do nothing if you don't want to do anything, right? So I think, like, my utopia is building systems, bureaucracy, that are self-sufficient and provide for the people and will just continue to function with minimal input or maintenance required. And then the only function of people in the society is to perform the maintenance as it's needed to keep the systems running. Mm-hmm. So a little bit of automation, but not from, like, a total technical standpoint, almost like green automation, you know, the idea that If you put the types of plants that thrive in this environment here, they will continue to grow food forever and you don't have to do much. The food just comes, that kind of a thing. Mm. And I think it ties in with a lot of our podcast episodes, right? Because that's our first episode about front lawns, how if you get rid of front lawns and you put in naturally occurring plantscapes, they could feed communities and all of these things. And I think it also ties in with, education and access to public transportation and how urban density models for public transportation are better for the planet. You don't have so much pollution. The more local things are, the more people can walk to everything they need, how that's good for the environment. Mm-hmm. So I think it takes all of it into account. It's just rationally planned systems of living that serve the most people possible in the community. Mm. But the sci-fi spring-off point is definitely you get to live forever. You get to live forever if you want. That's where it starts. And then everything else has to be built in order to accommodate that one truth. I don't know. What's yours, though?
my sci-fi one.
Yeah, what's your sci-fi one?
Ooh, I hate to leak any information.
Oh, you don't have to. It can be a secret. We'll wait for the book.
But I do imagine, like in a sci-fi, utopia, it's, like, similar. Or, like, similar to The Dispossessed, which I've been very into. Which is, like, there is no money. You don't need to work. It's, like, not based on accumulating capital. It's not based on ownership, not based on, hierarchies, not, like, it's basically when you're just at a really cool, chill party and there's no host, everyone's just getting along, everyone's having a good time, but yet things are getting thrown in the trash when the plastic cups are getting thrown in the trash. People are helping out in the kitchen, doing dishes. People are still having fun, like they're dancing, but like maybe they're helping out their friend who isn't having such a good time. Like, that's what I imagine.
I like that. I definitely think that moneyless economies are the crux of a utopian future for me.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah, it has to be a non-monetary economy for it to function. And the no hierarchy.
Yeah.
The organization, but no hierarchy. And I think we talk about this a lot, but just the idea of deciding not to care who's working more or less than you.
Yes. Who cares?
That might be a part of the culture war people don't talk about.
Yeah. And I think that's definitely like what I'm thinking about, especially like in our current time and place, like especially with like work culture and like, especially with like people, celebrating working like 80 hours a week and bossing around.
Yeah,
like I think that's like at the forefront of my mind when like the first thing I think of is like, well, we don't have to work, and work isn't your worth is not based on your work.
Right, and that's a reflection of the culture we live in where so much emphasis is based on the job.
Yeah,
the job, which just by virtue of its existence makes like class division so apparent, right? Because you have the owner class and the worker class, and the worker class has the job. But what if you could get everything done in society that you need without it needing to be based on a job model?
Yeah. No jobs in utopia.
No jobs in utopia. Just doing the shit you think needs to get done.
Yeah, just partying, man.
I like that. No jobs in utopia, only partying, and everyone lives forever.
Yeah. Utopia or else.
So if you're a regular listener, you'll know that we sometimes will answer questions that people leave us on our Patreon. Our Patreon is patreon.com/pickmeupimscared. It's $2 a month and you'll have access to a link where you can leave us a voice message and we respond to you either in a Patreon only bonus episode or on our regular episodes. We did have somebody write into us though on our Patreon. They were too nervous to leave a voice message but had a question. So we thought we'd go ahead and read that question and then answer it today on this episode. So here's the message we received. I'm 17, she/her/I don't care, and I really want to move out of my parents' place in a legal way without being emancipated just because of the lengthy process. I've already talked to my two recent therapists about it, as well as my parents, and somehow I've convinced all of them that it's the best thing for me, which I believe is true, but I won't get into that. I have a stable job that pays well and I can support myself financially. My main question is, am I able to do this legally? Because all of the Googling I've done just makes me more confused about the laws and stuff. I have a lot of friends as well with toxic parents who I think would benefit from this info. Thank y'all for your time, even if you can't respond. Oh, and she's from Kansas City. So, Kenna, you moved out as a teenager on your own, right?
I did. I moved out when I was 17.
I also moved out as a teenager before the age of 18. And I remember I just lied on my application to get a place and nobody ever checked. But that's not legal, one, and it's not replicatable. Nobody, yeah. You can't count on being able to do that. But you actually did it in a legal way, right?
Yeah, my mom signed off on everything because I graduated school early. So by the time I went to college, I wasn't 18.
I had the same issue, yeah.
So basically when I lived at an apartment or at a dorm before I was 8, when I was 17, my mom just had to sign off for everything. But my mom is very lovely and she's willing to sign all that paperwork and stuff.
So there is a way then to do it legally if your parents are on board that's not a full emancipation, because that's what your mom did for you to live alone.
Yes, she just had to sign off and basically like with a lease, she had to be on the lease in addition to me.
Got it. So that might be a good option. If your parents are on board, they might just have to also sign on to your lease for a little bit for the next year until you're 18 and can legally enter a contract on your own. The emancipation process is super lengthy. You know, it's a little easier if your parents are willing to sign off on the emancipation, but I also looked it up and you can be emancipated without your parents signing off, which I know isn't what the person was asking about, but I thought might just be an interesting additional information. You can have paperwork filed that's emancipation by court decree without your parents consenting. But in order to do that, you need to have a job and also already have a place to live, which how are you going to get a place to live
if yeah
without the parents being on board? And if your parents are on board to sign off on you having a place to live, do you really need to get emancipated, or can you just go the regular emancipation route since they're already clearly on board with you living a more independent life? So I think that the best thing to do in this situation for the person asking specifically would be to ask their parents if they're comfortable signing a lease for them to move into an apartment.
Yeah, or, you know, it's so hard to give advice because I don't know all the legalities of everything, and I wouldn't want to lead anyone astray, but you might be able to find a place where your parents are more comfortable signing off, where they don't have any like...
Oh, where your parents aren't tied to the lease. Because if your parents sign the lease, yeah, they're legally accountable for the apartment as well. And I know one of the things I ran into, for example, when I wanted to go to college, I didn't have enough credit to take out student loans on my own, but my parents wouldn't co-sign or couldn't co-sign on my student loans. And that became an issue. So yeah, if your parents are resistant to or can't get approved for you to sign a lease on your own, you might look into alternative housing options that are like staying with a friend, renting a room from a friend's house, or like a family friend, if they know your situation and your parents can tell them like, hey, yeah, this is fine. Or even maybe like subletting from somebody, yeah. You might be able to do that. So I think there are alternative housing options besides just signing a lease on an apartment. But I think if your parents are open to helping you sign your own lease on an apartment with them as co-signers, that would probably be the easiest and fastest way to do it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I know it just depends on how comfortable you are communicating with your parents about this, how stressful it is, etc., because everyone's parents are going to respond differently, you know, to this information and this request. And your parents sound like they're pretty on board, so that might be a good option. The other thing you can do, which is kind of funny and weird, is if you have a friend who's 18, you could literally just marry them and that would instantly emancipate you.
Whoa.
And then you can just get divorced when you turn 18 or whatever if you want. But yeah, in most states, look it up specifically for your state, but in most states, if you are over the age of 16 and you marry somebody who is 18, I think it does instantly emancipate you.
Whoa, weird.
Weird, right? Yeah.
That's so weird to me because it's like you can't buy cigarettes when you're 18 anymore, but you can get married.
Well, I think you would need your parents to sign off if you're a minor. Again. But if your parents would sign off and you marrying a friend, that might bypass the lengthy process of the emancipation.
Yeah, but I think at that point, if you could just get them to sign a lease.
Right, signing a lease might be easier. But if they don't want to be financially responsible for whatever reason, if you're like, hey, I got my buddy, will you just sign off on me marrying my buddy so I can I have basically the power to sign a lease on my own.
Or possibly just be like if you have a savings account, you know, to be like, I have like X number amounts, months rent saved to show to your parents or someone else, that might make them more willing to sign off. If you're like, that's I have true. Like, you know, 6 months worth of rent saved up, or 2 months or 3 months. So it's very unlikely that this lease would fail.
Yeah. Another thing too, which took me time to learn, is you can literally sometimes just call lawyers and ask them questions and they'll give you info for free if it's fast and easy. And especially if you're a kid and they kind of like you, like you could just start calling law firms and be like, hey, could I do this? And if it's an easy to answer question that only takes them 5 minutes, sometimes lawyers will just be like, all right, let me give you a little info. Here's what you can do.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, I think we always think like talking to a lawyer will cost like $1 million per minute or something. Mm-hmm. But some people, especially if they specialize in like anything having to do with like child welfare in any capacity, some people will just help you because you're a kid and they want to help you and they want to tell you your options. Yeah. So Kenna and I are not lawyers, and we are also from a different state.
Yes.
So the rules change from state to state. So you also, I know you're from Kansas City, but I also know Kansas City is like half in Missouri and half in Kansas. So,
oh, yes.
So depending on your state, I think you maybe look into that because it will vary specifically. So, but yeah, the easiest way I think definitely is just to have your parents co-sign a lease on an apartment if that's an option.
Yeah.
But I'm excited that you're embarking on a new route of independence.
Yes. Independence is great.
It's amazing. I hope that it'll be a good process for you. And I hope, even though we couldn't give you concrete information based on where you live and based on us not being able to give you legal advice because we're not attorneys, I hope we at least gave you some ideas to get your brain kind of going, like thinking about new creative options that you can look into and pursue. Because it is hard. It's hard when you're in a position as a teenager where you're in that liminal state between childhood and adulthood, but you feel pretty capable of taking care of yourself mm-hmm. at the very least, and maybe even more qualified than your family sometimes. And then you're like, okay, where do I go from here though? Mm-hmm. And that's hard. And it's also worst case scenario, you're 17, you're almost 18. You got a year to go, which I know sounds like a long, long time, but depending on your situation, you might also find that, hey, it's easier for me if I just put my head down and zone out the world and just make it through another year, which isn't fun. But again, depending on the situation you find yourself in, that might even be something that's ultimately long-term worthwhile for you to do, because your whole adult life is just about to start, right? Mm-hmm. And only you know how bad your situation is, how much more you can take. But a year in the greater scheme of things, you got your whole life to make your own and do what you want and live something that's good for you. And of course, you don't want to be in like an abusive situation. Obviously, you don't want to be in a situation where you're being actively harmed. But depending on your home environment, that might be also something to consider. I don't know.
Yeah.
Can you think of any other advice, Kenna, that might be?
Not really. I feel like you covered it. It's so hard, you know?
Yeah. And every family's different. Every person's different. And unfortunately, every state has different laws. So it's, it's a lot to navigate. It's really tricky. But you sound like a person who takes a lot of initiative, who's very decisive, who knows what's best for you and what you want. And I trust you personally. Yeah. I trust you to make a good decision for yourself.
And I wish you the best.
Yeah, totally. Good luck with everything. And thank you so much for writing into us.
Yeah.
Okay, wait. So Kenna and I were also just talking about this more after we stopped recording. And we were like, damn, the real like 30-something advice is that you can probably also expect to live with a bunch of roommates and for it to be kind of shitty, because it's really hard figuring out how to live with people. But I find that even if you have shitty roommates, it's better than living with your parents sometimes. Because at least you have the autonomy to be like, fuck this, I'm out.
Yeah,
you
know? Or like, I'm in my room now.
Right. Nobody's going to violate the sacred space of your room, probably. But, you know, a lot of the places that we lived from an early age, Kenna pointed out, and I'm like, yeah, that's true. We didn't even live there legally. Like, we weren't on the lease. It was like friends of friends. Someone had an opening in their place. You know, it was like sublet. And I know you mentioned that, you know, you wanted to do it super legally, but I feel like that's one of those things that's just normal, especially in bigger cities. And it's not technically legal, I don't think, but it's really common. And it's so common, in fact, that many cities with rent control will have specific rent control rules protecting people in those situations.
Yeah, for subletters.
Yeah, so like in San Francisco, for example, you didn't have to be on a lease to be considered legally a tenant and have all the rights afforded to you there. Mm-hmm. So that was just an addendum we thought of where we're like, actually, in real life, like in practice, how this usually goes is you just move in with friends of friends who have a room open and you're not even on the lease and you're just paying like your buddy Sponge your monthly rent or whatever. Yes. You know, and like, and that's how it goes. So
yeah, and you just pay your rent on time,
nobody asks questions.
Yes.
Pretty much. So that's the, Kenna was like, that's the after hours advice, and I was like, fuck, we should just add that in here. It is the after hours advice, but it's also kind of the real world advice, you know. So that's it, that's our addendum. But while we're here, I would also like to add, anybody who's listening, if you want to hear us ramble for 10 minutes in response to a question you have, sign up for our Patreon. It's $2 a month. But also, don't feel pressure if you don't want to give us your $2 a month. We totally get it. And that's it. That's my pitch. That's all I got. Thank you guys for being here, as always.
Thank you.